It's Friday, July 10th, 2015, and this is The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and this is a Friday for the history books. Yo, out there beyond Neptune. Hey, Pluto is right. We are just days away from a first-ever flyby of Pluto. The NASA New Horizons probe will be there early next week. It's already sending back Pluto selfies. Actually, it was launched before there were any selfies, so it will just be pictures of this once-planet, now-planet-like asteroid-comet thing. That's historic. And I've just got to say, the canyons of Broadway right here in New York City are mobbed with the fans of the Team USA Women's Soccer World Cup champions, the first-ever Canyon of Heroes parade for a women's sports championship. It's well-deserved and overdue, and wouldn't you rather cheer for Carly Lloyd than some old New York Yankee?
Lloyd strikes and scores 2-0 U.S.
And before they clean the streets, maybe they should have another parade for Serena Williams, who's in the Wimbledon final in tennis again.
I don't need any more titles to make it. So every time I step out on the court, the practice court, the match court, I do look at it as a more fun time.
But that's all just to brighten your day. We begin this Friday Takeaway with a discussion of what could be yet another Obama legacy issue, changing the U.S. relationship with Iran. The talks in Vienna, though, have passed another deadline and have been postponed. But there is no sign that the resolve to get a deal somehow is slipping.
We are not going to sit at the negotiating table forever. We also recognize that we shouldn't get up and leave simply because the clock strikes midnight.
Is this momentum from Secretary of State John Kerry or a diplomatic smokescreen? Over the past 2 weeks, Iran, the U.S., Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and China have twice extended deadlines for completing a long-term deal to curb Tehran's nuclear activities in exchange for sanctions relief. Missing this deadline, though, means that under U.S. law, Congress gets a chance to review the deal, inviting another political fight in Washington the White House has been eager to avoid. Thomas Erdbrink, Tehran bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times, says up until this week, Iranians have been really counting on this deal happening.
A lot of people here, ordinary Iranians, would tell you if you would step into the elevator or sit with them in a shared taxi that the nuclear deal was already done. They argued that this deal was already made behind the scenes and that the Western powers, together with Iran, were just searching for the right moment to announce the deal. Now, with yet another extension announced on Thursday evening, it suddenly dawned upon them that there might not be a nuclear deal, an option that a lot of people didn't think was possible until yesterday. And you can really see a change in the way people are thinking.
Do Iranians think this is inevitable? And if they're disappointed, what will be the consequence?
Well, Iranians, of course, live in an isolated country with a leadership that tries to control the news flow towards its population. Most people, when they are interested in nuclear talks, they listen to the state TV. And state TV has been very optimistic over the past weeks over these talks, sort of lulling all these people in a maybe false sense that this deal was actually going ahead as planned. Now that state TV is changing its tone, people are sensing that things are going wrong. Iranian officials, the first and foremost, Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif, the man we all know in the West as the Western-educated career diplomat who lived in the United States, in New York, actually, for almost 30 years, he came on TV yesterday and he was saying, look, it is not us, the Iranians, who want to leave the negotiating table. No, it is the Americans that keep on changing their mind and that don't show the political will to solve these important outstanding issues. Now, this is an indication that the Iranian leadership is preparing for a plan B. And of course, what will they do? They will blame the United States, as Iran's supreme leader has been warning Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, saying that he doesn't trust the United States, but wants to give these negotiations a chance.
If you look out on the streets of Tehran and talk to people that you speak with every day, who do you think has bet the most on these sanctions being lifted? What economic sign is there that someone has basically bet the farm that this is going to happen, even if it doesn't?
Well, it is clearly those ordinary Iranians that in news articles you will only see as, you know, Ali, the baker, or Fatemeh, the lawyer, or Ahmad, the taxi driver. It is those people that are not organized like the country's hardliners, but ordinary people who are looking for a better life, middle-class people who want their children to be able to study abroad. They have been living on the hope that these talks would change their situation. And those people, if you talk to them now on the street, they are the ones that are very, very worried.
How has the profile of John Kerry been in the Iranian media throughout these talks? Is he someone with a lot of credibility? Do Iranians have a lot of hope in him, or is he just another American official?
No, absolutely not. He is definitely seen as one of the most reasonable Americans that the Iranian nation in the past 35 or 36 years since the revolution has come across with. And that also has a lot to do with the fact that state television, which I said is the main information dissemination tool in this country, has been showing him in a reasonably positive light. Mr. Kerry is seen as the exponent of President Obama, the man who is interested in sort of a deal. But at the same time, the Iranian leadership very firmly believes that the American political system, as they call it, is not capable of cutting a deal with the Iranians because their systems, their political ideologies are just too different.
Is that an indication that passing this deadline, which now opens the door to the U.S. Congress to review the sanctions fight all over again, is going to give the Iranians an excuse to say exactly that, that the U.S. can't be trusted?
Well, absolutely. And I'm sure that some of the hardliners here have been betting on this all along, that they have been hoping that even if there would be a deal, that Congress, which is always shown as the bad cop here by the Iranian state TV, would actually, in a way, damage it or even try to, break this deal into pieces. So, of course, this longer period gives Iranian hardliners also more time to come out against the deal, and it would definitely be fantastic for them if this deal would fail at the hand of the Congress, because that gives them the opportunity to tell all the other Iranians that Iran's hardliners have been right all along.
Thomas Erdbrink is Tehran bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times, speaking to us from Tehran. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
And speaking of Congress, we don't know if he's ever been called a bad cop before, but we're joined now by Dan Kildee, Democratic congressman representing Michigan's 5th District. Congressman, welcome.
Hi, John. How are you?
So I'm great. And you're watching this very, very closely because there are some human faces detained in Iran that are very much on your mind. Why don't you remind us all of the detainees that you're concerned with, including one who's in your district?
Well, that's right. There are at least three individuals, maybe a fourth, in Iran. Amir Hikmati is a young man from my hometown of Flint, Michigan, who has been now almost 4 years in an Iranian prison. Of course, we know about Jason Rezaian, the Washington Post reporter, whose trial is apparently still underway. Pastor Saeed Abedini is still being held. And the fate or condition of Robert Levinson is unknown. And so what we've obviously been asking for is that Iran release those three Americans and provide whatever information they have about Mr. Levinson. Obviously, that would make a big difference to the families and would send a pretty strong signal that Iran is serious as it attempts, apparently, to rejoin the global community.
Robert Levinson, of course, former FBI agent who has been missing since 2008. Now, Dan Kildee, do you have any information that the fate of these detainees in for various reasons, and you've outlined very well the various different situations for them, are they bargaining chips? Are they on the table? Are they specifically part of the bargaining here, or are they something over on the side?
Well, they've definitely not been a part of the consideration, and we don't want, the families don't want that to be the case either. After all, number one, these families, the family I represent, the Hikmati family for sure, and Amir himself, would not want to have his fate tied to the uncertain outcome of a negotiation that many think could go 50-50 at best, number one. Second, we wouldn't want ever to be in a position that we would exchange the freedom of innocent Americans for concessions that might make the world a less safe place. So if they were part of the transaction, by definition, something would have been given in order to secure their freedom. And that something would be perhaps a step that would make the world a less safe place. And we don't want that. The Americans being held don't want that. And I know Amir Hikmati himself has said he does not want to be traded for something at the negotiating table.
But is it fair to say that if they do get a deal and we can move beyond this, that a distraction is suddenly off the road and it could be more clear sailing?
I would hope so. And I think the Iranian government must be coming to the understanding that as they continue to hold these Americans, that it's a liability to them. It's a liability in terms of the way the world, and speaking more for myself and my colleagues, the American Congress, it's how we perceive them. After all, it's impossible for us to erase from our mind Iran's other behavior when we consider the efficacy of any agreement or any engagement that Iran chooses to seek with the rest of the world, whether it's a nuclear agreement or commercial or, you know, economic engagement with the rest of the world. It's impossible for us to erase their other behaviors from our thinking when we consider their position on the globe.
Speaking of behavior, and it could be a slightly sensitive subject here, but how do you assess the potential for really making things much worse for you if Congress reviews this deal? The Iranians, of course, call Congress the bad cops here, that they don't want a deal. Do you think that your Republican colleagues have been responsible in the way they've criticized this deal, or are you concerned?
Well, I think some of them have been responsible. You know, and I have good relationships with thoughtful members on both sides and have worked with thoughtful members like Ed Royce on both sides of the aisle. But, of course, there are voices that right now, it wouldn't matter what was in this deal, they would oppose it, and they've made it very clear. I think the actions of Senator Tom Cotton, for example, and the others that sort of went along with his efforts were clearly intended simply to scuttle any agreement without any consideration as to what would be in it. I actually think at the end of the day, there are enough thoughtful voices in Congress on both sides of the aisle on this question that given the structure of the way Congress will consider it, that we will make a judgment based on whether the agreement, if it is reached, will simply make the world safer. And I think that ultimately at the end of the day will rule our thinking.
Well, it's good to hear. Dan Kildee, watching the Iran negotiations in Vienna very, very closely. He's a Democratic congressman representing Michigan's 5th congressional district. Dan, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, John.
Gaza. The name itself signifies crowded refugee camps, armed militants, rockets and airstrikes, periodic all-out war. This thumbprint of warm breezes and sandy beaches on the eastern Mediterranean is red with the blood from generations of conflict. Lise Doucet, chief international correspondent for the BBC, has reported on Gaza for more than two decades. She's always wanted to tell the story of how children in and around Gaza come to understand their violent world. Children of the Gaza War is a documentary portrait of how children grow up understanding that just across the way, over a fence, beyond the trees, is your enemy, an enemy you may never know.
It still amazes me that these children growing up on both sides of this border live just miles apart from each other. And yet, with every conflict, and don't forget last year's summer war was the third war in 6 years, these children grow ever further apart. You talk to their grandparents and they talk of a time when the Israelis and Palestinians went back and forth. I met a woman in the kibbutz of Nahal Oz who said that she bought her wedding dress in Gaza and how they used to go shopping there and eating there and how her friends from Gaza came to her wedding. But now, this generation, they have absolutely no contact between each other. So not surprisingly, you hear expressions of hatred. You know, we stand with Samar on the Gazan side of the border, and she's on the roof on her grandfather's house. And she points out to me, there's the Israeli customs house, there's the Israeli border. And all that she knows of Israel is like in the same way the children from the other side see Gaza's jagged skyline. She sees the same from her rooftop. And all she knows is that forces come from that side. They took away her father's life. They attacked the school where they had taken shelter, an attack that also injured her mother. Her own house lies in ruin. And so all that she knows of the other side is a side that hates her and wants to cause her suffering. So, of course, she only expresses hatred for that side. And I think not only does it tell us tragically a sort of sad story of today, it gives us glimpses into a tomorrow. And for the children who live on the Israeli side, of course, they live in very different physical and political circumstances. In southern Israel, children there, if they're old enough, have been living with rockets fired from Gaza for the last 13 years. And we heard from the children there that during the war, they were told very strictly by parents and teachers, never be more than 14 seconds from a bomb shelter. That is how long it would take to reach there safely without being in the path of a rocket in case it should fall exactly where they were. So in other words, on both sides, they live with a sense of fear, they live with a sense of anger and frustration, but what they do share is a real indignation and sometimes anger that they are being robbed of the kind of childhood they all understand should be the childhood they live, but is not at all the kind of life that they are leading.
In these two different realities, can you describe something a child said or the way that they acted that indicates just the impact that this has had on them in very different ways on the Gaza side and the Israeli side?
We met a very precocious 10-year-old girl, Michal, in Nahal Oz, and she was fortunate in that she and all the other children who live in Nahal Oz were taken away from the front line into shelters in northern Israel, so they escaped the worst of it. But when she got back to her home, she saw that a rocket had hit it when she was away, and she was articulate enough to be able to express her emotions.
Nobody can tell us not to be scared of these situations. It's scary. I'm scared. I could deal with it, though.
But she also expressed some understanding of the other side. She said, you know, this war, we were born into it, she says. It's not because of us, and it's not because of the kids in Gaza. We heard a different take on that with another girl a little bit further north in Sderot. She was 10 years old. Her name was Agam. And when she and her brother summoned up enough courage to go to the highest ridge in Sderot after the war has ended, and they looked through binoculars at Gaza and they gasped and they said, look at that destruction. But yet they also said, those are the houses of people who want to destroy us. And when I said to Agam, but there are kids on the other side, just like you, your age, and they're scared as well. And she said, very matter-of-factly, well, it's either us or them, so obviously it has to be them. But having said all that, kids being kids who show an extraordinary resilience and an ability to turn a page, we did hear, though, some glimmers of hope. For example, a 12-year-old Abdul Rahman, the son of a Hamas fighter, so his neighborhood was targeted as a Hamas stronghold by Israeli forces. He lost 17 members of his family, including his father. I first met him when he was in tears, when he saw the wasteland where he used to live.
They will not destroy us no matter how much they demolish. If they cut down the trees, we will replant. If they had no mercy on trees, how can they be expected to have mercy on human beings? Is it right that children around the world can live and play in comfort and safety while we live in death and destruction?
And he said, I'm going to seek defiance. They can send as many rockets as they want. We're going to avenge them. But then months later, because we followed all these kids for many months, when I said, do you really want the war to come back, Abdul Rahman? He goes, no, I don't want to be a fighter, he said. I want to fight them with my education. I'm going to invent things. That's how I'm going to be in the future. So even in the months that we spent with these kids, we saw that despite their circumstances and very traumatic circumstances, they were able to see through to the future and trying to imagine a different future. Although the doctors all say that you can't properly deal with trauma unless the causes of that trauma are removed, and that's not going to happen anytime soon.
You've been in Syria. You spent a lot of time in Syria. That conflict is certainly not as old as what's gone on in Gaza. You've spent a lot of time in Afghanistan. What is it about the situation in Gaza, like these other seemingly unsustainable situations for human beings? What is it that keeps the situation in Gaza going on?
Well, as you know, John, just how complicated, how tangled and tortuous the process of trying to make peace between Israelis and Palestinians are. I first went to the region in 1994, which was just after the Oslo Peace Accord, and it's staggering that 20 years on, it hasn't really moved on. In fact, Israelis and Palestinians seem to think it has gone even further backward. You hear people talking about separation, about division, about losing hope in a peace process, which is all process and never reaching peace. It seems to get ever harder to achieve peace. But I think fundamentally, I believe one of the maxims of this conflict, which is that often the people on both sides are willing to go further than their leaders in being able to wish for the courageous kind of political decisions which would allow them to end this never-ending conflict.
Lise Doucette, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Good morning, Vietnam! Hey, this is not a test. This is rock and roll. Time to rock it from the Delta to the DMZ. Is that me, or does that sound like an Elvis Presley movie?
A shell of silliness and laughter on the outside. The brilliant Robin Williams was at his core deeply vulnerable. It's still hard to believe he's dead, even though it's been nearly a year since he killed himself. The movie Boulevard, shot before he died, shows a different kind of shell. Williams plays a middle-class man in his 60s with a stable marriage and an even more stable desk job. When Williams meets a young male prostitute, we get to see a different kind of vulnerability.
How long do we have here?
An hour. No, it's up to you.
I used to like being in motels when I was a little kid. It was kind of neat just being somewhere else. It was fun, you know, just being somewhere else.
This idea of being somewhere else becomes the metaphor for a sensitive coming-out story. Ditto Montiel directed the film Boulevard, and as he explained to Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer of the Movie Date team, directing Williams was like having a living archive of comedy and American manners at his disposal. Montiel says it feels sadly appropriate for a final role.
Every generation has grown up with a different Robin Williams. It's kind of a remarkable span. It's, you know, like you say, he's Mork, he's Jumanji, he's Academy Award winning, you know, actor, host. It's kind of incredible, you know, and so... You know, when you make a little movie, you have a super wish list, and then you have a wish list, and you have a real list, and you have a real list, you know. And, you know, that's like a dream. For me, he was perfect for the role in so many ways.
And this character's different from a lot of the other characters some of us know him to be. He's not a huge presence. He's not a big personality. He's someone who's living a mostly pleasant, mostly quiet life, but underneath the surface, there's a lot of pain and turmoil there, and some people have said that in real life, that's the kind of man that Robin Williams was. Did you see that in him?
You know, it's hard to tell, you know, because movies are such a weird, it's like life really fast, you know. You meet someone on a Monday and Tuesday you're trying to tap into anything you can so you can make a 40-year relationship feel real, you know. And then you go through all these emotions and 3 months later you say, see you later, and cut, and then you know, so it's a very strange circus life, you know, weird world. But so it's hard to tell the difference because, you know, you're talking about someone, and every once in a while, like I would say to Robin, you know, like, hey, man, you know, like, this is a big deal. You're walking in here. You totally screwed up. And he'd be like, yeah, I've done the research, you know, in a very Robin way, you know. So of course, there's a little piece, I'm sure, of course, in any artist's work, you know, so...
You've had Robin Williams is the latest in a pretty long string of rather major stars that you've had in your films. I mean, a short list would be Robert Downey Jr., Channing Tatum twice, Dwayne Johnson, Al Pacino. Why do you think these stars say yes to you? I mean, we are talking about smaller budget films here.
Yeah, tiny ones, you know. I don't know. You know, I mean, it ain't the money. I promise you that, you know. I mean... It would be nice to go out and make the next big blockbuster. No one's calling me, you know. So you try to find things that touch you for whatever reason they do, and then maybe that's the same thing that touches them, you know, different actors. And then, you know, I like to work with actors. I'm a real fan of it, and like the Woody Allen School of Film, I love it. You know, when I see people in his movies, I think you're probably pretty close to that guy, you know. So I try to hopefully work with the actors in a collaborative way, you know. David Mamet is the king, but I don't have that kind of talent. So I'll just sort of try to find a way to let's all put a little bit of ourselves into these guys and make them feel real. And maybe people like that, you know.
Now, speaking of collaboration, you actually collaborated with Robin Williams in the final cut of this film. Notably, there's one scene, a very strong scene in this film that you at one point didn't want in the film. And Robin Williams said, let's put that scene back in. And that was in the nursing home, his character with his dad. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I love the scene, and I think he's just great in it.
Something happened that summer, Dad. First, I couldn't figure it out. I didn't want to. But I knew. I knew that all the wishing and praying in the world couldn't change the fact that I was gay.
it was one of those things where I was like, I didn't know that that character could even say the word gay. I just thought it was so, oh, it was so buried. But I thought he just, we worked on that scene a lot, you know. And I mean, it was one take, you know, two cameras, one of our only two camera shots. And I knew the movie could live with or without it. And he, in the end, wanted it in, and he was right. And you know, you work with these people, you know. There's a scene when you talk about collaborating with, you know, him and Kathy Baker, who's just as great, you know. They lie in bed together and they have this conversation, and at the end they say, I love you, to each other. And it wasn't in the script. And we rehearsed it the night before. And you know, I was talking, I was like, maybe you should just tell her you love her, you know. And he said, yeah, let's give it a shot. And then he said, I love you. And then she said, I love you back. And initially the producers freaked out and they're like, why are they saying I love you? And I said, because they do, you know. And Robin was like, he was adamant from the beginning being involved in the film that, and I was on board entirely. This was, in a lot of ways, more the story of letting go than coming out. Of course, it's a huge deal. He suppressed being a gay man. I can't pretend that that's not a part of it. But to me, it was just a part of it. I thought it was a loving relationship with Kathy Baker, you know, and Kathy would say all the time to me, she'd look at me and she'd say, we had an unwritten agreement and he's breaking it. And I thought that was an interesting way of thinking of the film. You know, they did love each other, but now we have to let go. And the complications of their age making it not a simple coming out at 23, like married the wrong girl at 18, now I'm going to hit Chelsea, you know. Slightly different story here, you know.
So despite the serious tone of the movie, was Robin Williams funny on set? Did you see that side of him?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, it's a weird one. You know, he is Robin Williams and he is the guy from David Letterman, you know, that jumps off the chair. And that was kind of why I thought, how interesting that he can't do that in this movie, like, no matter what. But, you know, there are times, you know, you're out at 2 a.m. with a cast of crazies on the street and, you know, he'd start performing as he does. Once in a while, like he had, when Bob Odenkirk first showed up, you know, they're two great comedians and they had never met. So it immediately becomes this big comedic scene. So Robin would come over after they do some, you know, mess around for a minute. And he'd be like, where was I last night? And I'd be like, and, you know, in the movie. And I'd be like, in a motel with this guy and you totally lied to your wife. He's like, okay, no more joking, you know. So it was, you know, he was in check of himself at all times as well.
Ditto, Montiel. Thank you so much for joining us today. The new film is called Boulevard.
Cool. Thank you.
Any parent that has a kid understands that, heck, when your kid has a hangnail and you can't do anything to fix it, it makes you feel terrible.
Writer Fred Vogelstein's son Sam had more than a hangnail when he and his wife Evelyn embarked on a single-minded mission to find an effective treatment for Sam's seizure disorder. Sam's form of epilepsy began when he was 4. He would lose consciousness for 5 to 20-second bursts that could occur up to 100 times a day, disrupting conversations, class time in school, and team sports. By the time Sam was 11, no treatment had worked. Nothing had done more than dope Sam up for a while, an additional impediment to school and maintaining friends.
So, you know, after you've spent 7 years trying to help your kids' seizures go away and you've been unsuccessful, it's deeply upsetting. I mean, Sam doesn't have the kind of epilepsy that most people associate with epilepsy. He has something called, it's a form of absence epilepsy. It's a little bit like hitting the pause button on a DVD player. He'll basically be in the middle of doing something and he'll sort of stop and his jaw will go slack and his torso will bob forward rhythmically for like about 10 seconds and then it's done. So, you know, he's not tired when after he has one. He can finish a sentence after he has one. So, I mean, individually, they're kind of benign, relatively speaking, in the seizure world. The only problem is that when you're having, you know, 10 an hour, which winds up being one every 6 minutes, it's very, very, very disruptive.
Something kept Fred and Evelyn from doubting that there was a scientifically valid way out there to treat Sam's seizures, if they could just keep going.
What we saw in Sam was that if we could get his seizures to stop, he'd be a normal kid. You kind of keep fighting for your kid until you run out of bullets.
And what you don't run out of is medical research papers to read. Evelyn read thousands of them, and from a professional journal called Seizure, she learned about a pharmaceutical company in the UK called GW, which was experimenting with pure forms of the active ingredients in marijuana. One chemical, called CBD, seemed to do well in clinical trials on rodents, but it was illegal here in the United States. So Fred, Evelyn, and Sam hopped on a plane in search of illegal drugs. CBD didn't get Sam high, but his parents were over the moon on a journey that was just beginning.
The day that Sam showed up, he had 68 seizures. I think within 3 days, he was down to 2 or 3. It was miraculous, for lack of a better way of putting it. I mean, after you've tried 24 medications over the course of 7 years, we had never seen anything work this well with so few side effects.
So who was the first person you spoke to after this dramatic development in the United States in an official capacity who could start the process of possibly getting it approved above board for Sam to take in the United States?
We'd hired a consultant to help us push this through the FDA, and we'd hired a consultant to help us push this through the DEA. And essentially what we were told was that if we could come up with doctor-certified results from the UK, that would make a very compelling argument to the FDA. I was actually less worried about the FDA than I was about the DEA, because the DEA is a police organization. I wasn't entirely sure how what we were trying to do was going to play with them. But getting through the DEA turned out to be easier than I thought it would, remarkably.
And what do you think has been set in motion here in terms of changing the world for so many people with this kind of seizure disorder, including epilepsy?
What I hope has been set in motion from what we've done is a new drug to treat epilepsy, honestly. I mean, I certainly didn't expect that when we started the process. I mean, I did spend a lot of time when we were going through the process saying to everybody involved, I really don't want to be the only person that this helps. But what happened was that the company was so delighted and surprised by the results it saw with Sam in London that it decided to start investigating it in the United States. And so initially it started small trials with 5 neurologists at 5 hospitals with 25 kids. And the results there were so encouraging that it's expanded it now to what I think at the end of this year will wind up being 1,400 kids in 50 hospitals in the U.S. and the U.K. And so I've talked to enough people about the process of drug approval at the FDA is long, it can be long and complicated, but based on the results I'm seeing, you know, this could result in a drug that you can buy at Walgreens in 3 years.
And the results of what you've done have certainly contributed to Sam and many other people, as you've described in these tests. And if it does come to market, I mean, that will be a huge deal. About the only downside I can see here is that you almost got the chance to name a drug, but that didn't quite work out.
Oh, I think when everybody was very excited about how Sam responded to CBD in London, I think Jeffrey Guy, who's the chairman of GW, sort of talked about naming the drug after Sam, but it's okay. I can live with the fact that they didn't name the drug after me.
Sam can is a lot catchier than Epidiolex. Epidiolex.
Epidiolex.
Epidiolex.
Think it's called. I think that there's a whole science to drug naming here that I'll leave it to them.
Well, it's just irresistible. I mean, we're talking about cannabis here. We're talking about, an enormous effort on your part and great results. I mean, this is a long, strange trip.
Oh, without question. Without question. It's a life takes you places where you don't really expect it to. And I have to say, we're incredibly thankful for what has happened here. Being around Sam while he's been on this has been a little bit like living with Rip Van Winkle, in the sense that he's off every other epilepsy med that he was on, and he's starting to catch up at astonishing rates. And that's really amazing to see. For a long time, I was finding myself lacking the words to describing the feeling. And I finally came up with this. It reminds me of the first time, at least, I fell in love. you meet a girl for the first time, and for a month, 2 months, 6 months, whatever, everywhere you go, you seem to float from curb to curb. You know, the air seems like it sparkles, and very little can mess up your state of mind. I've been feeling that way about things in our life for the past 3 years. It's pretty amazing.
Fred Vogelstein, a very happy Fred Vogelstein, is contributing editor at Wired. His most recent article, Boy Interrupted, is about all of this. It appears in the July issue of Wired. Thanks, Fred.
Thanks for having me.
If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Have a great weekend. This is The Takeaway.